Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for inviting me to this meeting. I will talk about coherent control using light waves. So it's a strong field control. And I will give three examples of where this strong field control can be applied. One example on atoms, one on molecules, and then finally even nanostructures. So first of all, I really like to point out the people that have been involved in this work. It's not just me, it's a big group of people, partially from MPQ, partially from Kansas, and also a couple of collaborators that over the years we have worked with. So I will present some of this work that we've done with them. Okay, so motion on ultra-fast timescales. I will try to stay a little bit broader in the beginning so that you understand which direction I'm going to. I guess all of you know that femtochemistry is about the nuclear motion, so the nuclei moving on these timescales, on femtosecond timescales. And of course, there is coherent control well established in that field. If you move to timescales, then we come into the realm of attosecond physics. And this is where electron motion can be studied in a variety of systems, atoms, molecules, and even nanostructures. And this is what we'll talk about today. In fact, I will structure my talk such that I start on the molecules and then give you an example of correlated electron motion atoms, and finally some control of electron motion in nanostructures. Okay, so coherent control with pulse shaping is, of course, well established, also for strong field applications. But typically, what is controlled is our parameters like the intensity, frequency, polarization, or the pulse duration. And back in 2006, together with Mark Rucking, we started to wonder whether you can use the electric field waveform itself to control processes. And of course, we were in the first case interested in whether you can potentially control electronic motion in molecules using the field of a few cycle laser pulse. So the idea behind this is that we hit a molecule with a pulse, a short pulse, and that initiates electron motion. And ideally, this is a motion that, for instance, carries a charge from one side of the molecule to the other, and it might oscillate like shown here. And then on longer timescales, nuclear dynamics occurs. It's often coupled, in fact, to this oscillatory motion. And if we dissociate the molecule, then the idea is that, okay, if you can control the electron motion that basically determines the potentials on which, in the end, the nuclei move, we could potentially also influence the chemical reactions. Okay. So that this might work was theoretically shown first in back in 2004 by Fred Esri, a coworker of mine at Kansas State University, who, well, studied whether the carrier envelope phase of a few cycle pulse can be used to control spatial symmetry in a molecular reaction. So this is a few cycle pulse here, and the carrier envelope phase is basically that offset between the field envelope and the peak here of that electric field, as shown here in this formula. And by changing the carrier envelope phase, we can change the field. That's a very simple parameter to control it. So what Brett Esri did with his coworkers was to look at the HD plus dissociation. And you can form, if you imagine the molecule, the H atom sitting here on the left and the D atom on the right, then when they dissociate, you would imagine, okay, I would have H on the left and D on the right. In fact, where the charge, however, ends up is something that we might control. It can end up here on the deuterium, or it can end up on the hydrogen. And this is the type of control that they showed can occur with the carrier envelope phase. So when they change the carrier envelope phase of a few cycle pulse, they can steer the charge in that dissociation one way or the other. Okay, so when we started on this, we couldn't right away start with a molecular ion. That's still the preferred way to do it, to compare it more directly with the theory. But we started with actually D2, and then use the strong laser pulse to also ionize the molecule. So we end up in this D2 plus potential here. And then from there on, it can dissociate. One way to dissociate it in a strong field is bond softening, which goes actually all the way back to a paper by Phil Buxbaum. And then there's also the possibility that we can excite the nuclear wave packets in this ground state here to an excited state, and it dissociates from there. Okay. And finally, we can double ionize the molecule, but then there's no electron left to control it, so I will not talk about this channel today. We used an imaging technique. My group is the attosecond imaging group. We like to use imaging technologies to look at these processes. What you see here is the D-plus fragment from that reaction, so the red fragment here. And the laser polarization is horizontal. And basically, this is a cut through the 3D distribution of the D-plus ions that come off this reaction. At low momenta, so low radii here, you see the bond softening channel. And then at higher radii, you see the channel that comes directly from this excited state. So it gives higher momenta. OK, but the interesting thing, of course, is the control, because all of this was known before. And what we do now is we use a few cycle pulse, and we control the CEP of that pulse, the Carrier envelope phase, and look at where does the D plus ion go. In this picture, does it go left or does it go right? Yeah. You don't see that here with your eyes. This is for a random CEP. But if you lock the CEP, we can look at a parameter that is left minus right divided by the sum. This is a nice parameter because it goes from minus 1 to 1, depending on which side the D plus ion goes. And if it goes left here, it's red. If it goes right, it's blue. You can see that we can really control where the D plus ion ends up with this carrier envelope phase. Of course, we would like to understand how this is possible, how we can break the symmetry in this dissociation. And one simple explanation was given in our original paper comes from preparing a coherent superposition of two electronic states in the D2 plus. One of them is the ground state that has this wave function here. Looks a little bit like that. And then the excited state has a different parity. However, if we mix those two states, what we can do is we can localize electron density on the left or on the right. And this is the trick. Yeah? We couple two states, and by doing that, we can induce electron localization. And then if you look at this in a time-dependent way, what we imagine this to look like is we come with our few cycle pulse and basically localize the electron on one nuclei, and it starts to oscillate back and forth between the two. At the same time, the distance between the protons, the deuterions, is increasing, and then it breaks up. And at the time when it breaks up, the electron is going to be at one particular site, depending on the electric field of that few cycle pulse. In fact, if we change the CEP by pi, so we flip the field around here, its evolution, then the electron ends up on just the other deuterium, and that means we also change the ejection direction of the D plus ion. I have this as a movie as well, so this is a quantum calculation that shows how this occurs. The protons are in here, and this is basically the electron density hopping back and forth between the two as we go on in time. You see this is just a couple of femtoseconds here. And at some point, the electron cannot hop back and forth anymore because the distance is too large. And then it freezes out in a certain weight ratio between the two. This is a quantum calculation, so you still have density on the two. Of course, in a classical experiment, it would end up on one of them.
So, so at that point, you still have some probability.
Yes,
that's for right. It to be. So will you see, if you didn't measure, do you see some fraction of the time?
Yeah, so we measure an asymmetry that is not 1, for instance, and that means that we will have a certain probability that actually is here instead of there.
Yes. So 0.2 before the asymmetry, right?
Excuse me?
On your scale, I looked at a color-coded scale.
Yep.
The maximum asymmetry was 0.2.
Yeah, 0.2.
Yeah, so like 20%. Imbalance.
Yeah, 60 to 40. basically. That's right, yeah.
How far can you go with classical mechanics to predict the where the electron will be with respect to the carrier and the electric fields?
Well, what you need is this superposition. This is important. And there is semi-classical approaches, like a Landau-Zener type of approach that you can use to understand these processes. So I would say semi-classical approaches are definitely possible.
But let's say for the high harmonic generation,
right,
the classical electron picture works, you can go very far with that.
That's true. And that's because the electron motion in the continuum is very classical, usually. So that means that if you, for instance, want to understand how the recolliding electron here does the excitation, and you just calculate the kinetic energy from by classical means, that works really, really well.
Aren't you also, in this case, you're also using that superposition which most resembles the classical electron? That is, you're localizing all the charge in one place, what most of us would think of the classical approximation. So it seems like you are making a classical approximation, but if you carry that through and just take a classical trajectory all the way through, how different from the 20%? I mean, presumably it would be completely deterministic, 100%.
It would be 100%, and I think that's, I mean, would of course be a lack for the comparison to the experiment, but yeah. You would get that localization effect, I agree.
So the essential difference between the real world and classical physics analog is that you only have a 20% effect instead of 100%.
That's right, yeah. Okay, so how we understand this very simple reaction and the control of it is in three steps. We first have an ionization, then an excitation here, and that's important for the type of momenta that we observe, where the control actually occurs, and then a coupling between these two states. I will bring it a little bit closer to you by this picture. So if we just look at the bond softening distribution that comes here at very low kinetic energies, this is the blue part, the channel up here where we observe just dissociation from this excited state has very high kinetic energies. However, the asymmetry, so the control, is observed in intermediate range. Okay, so we always need a contribution from both states, and they need to overlap in the KR spectra to show that interference effect. That's basically what it is. Okay, so this is an effect that unfortunately goes down exponentially with pulse duration. So the question, of course, is, well, it's nice for hydrogen, but can you ever apply that to a larger molecule? And so we have thought about that. In fact, this exponential decay was predicted by a theory paper. And one way out of this is to change the wavelength. Okay, so a few cycle pulse at 800 nanometers is just a couple of femtoseconds short. However, if you go to 2.1 microns, something that we did, then a few cycle pulse can be as long as 20 femtoseconds or longer. And in fact, you use such a pulse for hydrogen, and we see that now, as compared to before, we have stronger control, and in particular, we get a really nice control of the bond softening channel. And that is because now the wave packet can make it all the way out to the region where the bond softening occurs, and then still couple the two states, and that induces a strong interference and therefore this asymmetry. So calculations also predict this. If you go here from 800 nanometers towards the mid-IR range, the degree of asymmetry and therefore control grows. So we applied this scheme to larger molecules. I will show CO here as an example. And I just want to make you aware that there are a lot of complications. And one of them is there are more complex potential energy curves that you have to work with. So more states that you could potentially couple with all different kinds of parity and electron densities. And then, well, also here, the dissociation doesn't end up in just one particular, so the atomic states might be different that you end up with, and still you need that interference, so this is another problem. Furthermore, for a heteronuclear molecule like CO, the ionization itself of the neutral CO can cause an asymmetry, because it might matter whether the C points up or the O points up in the ionization step. Okay, so it could be that we measure an asymmetry, but it's actually just from ionizing the molecule in a strong field rather than controlling electron motion. So this all has to be taken into account. Well, the good news is we see a symmetry here, and we believe it's not just from the ionization step. And also, what was interesting about this particular experiment was that we believe we could actually see indications here in that angular distribution from ionization of two molecular orbitals, not just the highest occupied molecular orbital, but also the next lower one. So to summarize this, the non-Born Oppenheimer dynamics in complex molecules is quite challenging, and of course a topic of high interest at the moment in attosecond physics. Controlling electron motion in these molecules is something that we are doing at the moment, or trying to do. And maybe coherent control methods, like closed loop control, might help with this.
Can you just go back to
the
answer?
Sure.
How do you expect the participation of the two orbitals to depend on wavelength?
Well, this is in a tunneling regime, so I would not necessarily expect this to play a large role, but if you're in the multiphoton regime, for sure. I mean, then it will be very different. In fact, what we saw was that the intensities were really, the two played a role, that range was very small. First of all, we need to have high enough intensity so we can sort of dig deep enough into the molecule to ionize the homo minus one. But then if we go to too high intensities, other processes take over. So in fact, the angular distribution here goes towards being oriented along the polarization axis. So this, it's a very small range. And it will very likely also depend on the wavelength. But to make exact predictions, I couldn't do it right now. It would be interesting to study this for sure.
Is it typically the saturation which makes the homo minus one to be competitive to the homo in these cases? This one have this small intensity and then
Could be, but I would think in this case we were not above the saturation intensity, because I mean CO has an ionization.
No, but just the slope starts really earlier to end down.
Yep.
And I would think that then the wavelength dependence, one of them would be at least that the saturation changes. So in that sense, the intensity would also be changing. If you keep the intensity fixed, you would probably see an effect from that.
Okay, I have to make a strong cut here to switch to another system. So we'd like to talk about correlated electron motion controlling that with the CEP. This is a very, very classical example from strong field physics. Indications of it were observed in just intensity-dependent ionization, multiple ionization, as you see here from this paper from 1982 from Andrieu and co-workers. There is a Ni structure in the double ionization. And more indications of what actually happens were found later, looking at the recoil of the doubly charged ions. You see there is this double hump structure, which in fact indicates that an electron recollision process is responsible for this. So how we imagine this to go is that first an electron goes out, comes back to the parent ion, and then kicks out a second electron if it's energetic enough, or excites the ion and it's tunnel ionized. The best way to actually look at electron correlation, or one of the best ways, is to really do a coincidence measurement of all the particles that come off such a multiple ionization, and then plot the momentum of the first electron versus the momentum of the second electron if you have a double ionization. And if these give you momenta that are correlated, in this case you see that, so we have blocks occurring here and there, then we know there is a strong correlation occurring. If this ends up to be just centered in the middle with no clear correlation between the two electron momenta, then there's no correlation. So this is the type of experiment we wanted to do, using the CP now to control what the electrons do as a function of CP. So we use short pulses. It has the advantage that we can neglect multiple recollisions. So we can really reduce it to a single recollision. This is good. And then look at the energy and momentum sharing between the two electrons as a function of this parameter. There has been really plenty of work on this from the theory side for single cycle pulses, because of course in theory it's easier to do calculations for short pulses. And you see that the correlation pictures here dramatically change depending on what the electrons are doing as they interact. Okay, since this is an experimental talk, I also have to at least show one or two slides on how we do this. This is an experimental setup that we built together with Joachim Ulrichs and Robert Moshammer's group from Heidelberg and Gerhard Paulus from Jena. And the idea here is we use a coincidence spectrometer to measure argon 2 plus ions at the same time as one or two electrons that come off the double ionization in coincidence for every single laser shot. And then also for every single laser shot, we measure the carrier envelope phase in this phase meter. So we don't even need to stabilize the laser, which is great because that means we can measure for days in a row. And that's really what is needed in such measurements. Okay, so this is how our correlation plots look like for short pulses, for 4 femtosecond pulses. A little bit different from what you have seen before. You get this cross-like structure here. But of course, the interesting part is what happens if we change the CP. So this is now for a phase of 15 degrees here. If I change the phase, then we can see how that electron correlation really changes as a function of phase. Okay? So the light waveform, or the CP, is a very good parameter to control electron correlation. And in fact, it's a parameter that helps us to sort of take out one of these pictures and analyze them in more detail. For instance, for this phase here, we observe two strong blobs here on those axes, and understand it by semi-classical calculations in this case, by basically one dominant ionization event with one recollision that emits the second photon then upon ionization by the field. This is a so-called Reser process. And we can even use these pictures to analyze this a bit more. And we can say, well, it's the second electron that carries the high momentum here, while the first one stays close to zero. And the highest ionization probability of the second electron occurs at a certain time. And that time is given basically by the delay here between the zero of the field and when the second electron is emitted. And we can extract this time from the momentum that the electron gains in the field. You can understand it basically classically. Just calculate how much momentum the electron gains from the remainder of the electric field when it's born at a certain time.
So the symmetry around the 45 degree line, that's just coming from the identity of the particles, isn't it?
The symmetry around this, yes, comes from the identity. We cannot distinguish.
So if I want to think classically, it's more interesting to just look at one half of that plane.
Yes.
Because then I see the correlation that the dynamical state.
You could do that too, of course. Yeah, that's right. If we change the phase, we can go to situations when we have two recollision events here, and then we see the according contributions on the two sides. As well. So this is something we can do experimentally. Okay, and then my last topic is on nanosystems. I don't want to go into all the details of this, but the idea is that we can control electron motion not just in atoms and molecules, but also in much, much larger structures. And what's interesting about nanosystems is that they exhibit a collective electron motion. So you're driving all the electrons basically by the field. Yeah, it's like a driven harmonic oscillator. And they can be resonant, which means that you will achieve extremely high amplitudes and would see according phase shifts in the driven motion. This is something that we are after and we want to see and control. And the time scales for this motion are in a few femtosecond range. So this is also interesting. It's an attosecond phenomenon. Okay, the experiment that we did on this was simple in the case or in the sense that we basically reproduce something that we know from atoms. We can shine a strong few cycle pulse onto an atom here, emit electrons, and they can leave directly. Yeah, these are the direct electrons. Or they can be driven back to the ion by the field and then rescatter. And if they rescatter, they achieve much higher momentum than the direct electrons. And it's usually possible to distinguish the two regions. This is an image here from xenon. You see it looks very beautiful. It has these rings here with actually different numbers of photons absorbed by the electron as it leaves the atom. And now we repeat this type of experiment on a nano system. So the question, of course, is how does that look like, and do we get the same energies or not? And can we control it? So in order to do that experiment nicely, we again combine measuring the Kerr envelope phase with measuring single shot the electron momenta. We have not done that in a coincidence machine, but in a velocity net imaging apparatus here. And then the nanoparticles are inserted as a constant stream of particles. It's like a pearl chain of isolated nanoparticles that runs through your vacuum chamber. That can be done using aerosol techniques. Okay, so let's look at the electron emission pictures. This is again for xenon, and an interesting parameter that gives us the idea of how the phase controls this emission is the asymmetry again. So it would be the up emission minus the down divided by the sum, because the polarization axis is along this direction. And we get, this is the asymmetry here, we get these contributions with those stripes that are show a slight tilt with energy. And this is actually all really well understood and can be quantitatively compared to calculations. For the nanosystems, you see now the picture is maybe not as it's not similar to what we observed for atoms. First of all, a lot of the structure is missing. Most important, this was the exact same intensity here, but we observed much higher momenta. So there's an additional acceleration occurring. But importantly, we can control the emission, especially at these high momenta with the CP. And this is important because it tells us that whatever we do to the electrons in the nano system, we do it on a few cycle basis. Yeah? So if you shine a strong pulse onto a nanoparticle, it can, to overstate it, it can explode. And in that explosion, you can, of course, obtain high energy particles. And however, this is a thermal process, and you would not expect the CEP to play a role there. So the fact that we observe the CEP dependence means that whatever drove those electrons to the high energies has to be a field-driven process. And together with Thomas Fennell, we compared our experiments to calculations where, first of all, we have taken into account the near field around the nanosystem. So this is a nanoparticle here of 100 nanometers diameter, and you can see that if the laser pulse goes through the system, that at the poles of the particle, the field is enhanced. This near field enhancement plays, of course, a role for electron acceleration, because we emit the electron near the surface, and then it, as it goes out, it sees the near field instead of the laser field. So that gives it an extra kick. Furthermore, since we have isolated particles that are not connected to ground or anything, we can, as we emit electrons, we can charge the system. And this additional charge has an effect also on the electron trajectories. If we include both effects, this is just a near field, this is including the charges and also the charged surface for the recollision, then we observe a cutoff here that lies at close to 50 times the quantum mode potential. This is 5 times more than we observe in atoms. So this additional acceleration by itself was an interesting observation.
Does it make any sense to ask this question? That might be a nonsense question. What's the average charge that the cluster charges up to because of the action of the field?
It's about 20 electrons, something like this. So it's significant. Yeah. Of course, it depends on the intensity. Highly, it depends on the intensity, but in this range, it was about that number. Okay, if we do calculations and observe then how many of these electrons stay attached and leave the particles, these are trajectories, trajectory calculations, we can first of all see that there is a trapping field that builds up that keeps low energy electrons inside this field. So by charging the particle up, the low energy electrons never make it out. We never observe them, which in fact leads to the momentum pictures that we have seen, namely all the direct electrons are missing, while only the rescattered, the high energy ones, are making it out. So that smears out the momentum pictures. And this picture here also shows that there is a CP control. This was for a certain carrier envelope phase, and this is the left side, this would be the right side. So there's an asymmetry that occurs as a function of the field.
Does it charge up over several cycles?
It charges up over a few cycles, that's right. Yeah. In fact, it starts very early in the pulse. You can already... the IP is 10 EV, roughly, and that means that for a pulse that's well in this range, you probably have ionization, significant ionization here, but you will also have ionization later, and some of the electrons that are born might be born, for instance, too late to be significantly accelerated. Others that are born early might still get trapped by interaction of the electrons with each other or with the field. In fact, we can do calculations where we observe that what happens to the electrons are the number of the collisions they undergo. This is from theory. We can see that what we expect to see in the momentum pictures is that the direct electrons give this very tiny contribution here in the center, while the rescattering electrons give a much, much larger contribution at high momenta. And if you go to many collisions, then this A-type structure washes out to a disk. And this is really what we would call this a thermal background that we have when the electrons undergo a lot of collisions. And in this case, also the CP control would be much smaller. Luckily enough, that contribution, this is a logarithmic plot here, is very, very small. But still, it's there. And this is just from the theory. In fact, in the experiments, we believe we see a few more of those. So this is the total electron yield as we recorded with our BMI. And you don't quite see this A-type structure. However, what we can do is we can just take the CP-dependent electrons and plot the amplitude of those. And then we get the A-type structure. Okay, so this is a way to get rid of the thermal electrons, because we assume that everything that has a CP effect can undergo a certain number of collisions. Otherwise, it would not show this effect anymore. And yeah, that agrees quite nicely with the theory. Okay, so a little bit over time, but to let me summarize this. The light, what I showed was light waveform control of electron dynamics in atoms, molecules, and nanostructures. I could only scratch the surface with this talk. But nevertheless, there is interesting dynamics that can be controlled in the strong field regime, including correlated electron emission, strongly coupled electronuclear motion, like in this non-Born-Oppenheimer regime for molecules. And finally, with nanostructures, we just started. We believe there's even more processes happening at higher intensities for larger particles and so on. One way to into the future would be to use arbitrary shaped waveforms. There was a talk by Lefteris Guillaume-Marcus on this, using light waveform synthesis, and then of course coherent control methods could sort of determine the optimal field for a certain desired observable. And also, we haven't really used optimal control yet, so there's no feedback in these experiments, but of course, that could be implemented as well. thank you for your attention.
So you're thinking of optimal control only in terms of using feedback, or maybe some other techniques, what you have in mind?
in contact atoms?
So we started to do some optimal control together with velocity map imaging, together with Eric Wells from Augustana College. And I think in general this would be interesting to use genetic algorithms to use some of the well-established means to maybe increase the type of control that we have. Because we still would like to work with the waveform of the laser field. It's still a strong field effect. But of course you can imagine that it doesn't have to be just a Gaussian pulse. It could have some other form. And if we have some feedback, a self-learning loop that optimizes this field, hopefully we can learn something in addition.
Yeah, we have an algorithm that probably in this case will work much better than genetic in, for this learning loop. So maybe we can talk about that.
Yeah, yes. Sounds good.
Silicon dioxide is an insulator, right?
So yes.
I'm amazed, you know, the electrons do anything to do it, because as soon as you sort of accelerate them up and then they're going to bang into all the ions in the lattice before they get out. That's not the collisions you're referring to. We're talking about collisions of electrons with each other.
Well, yes. I mean, there's of course the collision of the electron with the sort of site where it originates. Yeah. And that's also responsible for high harmonic generation. But there's other collisions where the electron sort of is slowed down by colliding with another site, right, on the surface, and this occurs as well. In our experiments, we cannot distinguish between the two, so we observe basically the sum over all of these events.
So presumably these little things get really hot.
I would assume so, yes.
If you don't see that,
we can potentially measure the temperature by that thermal background that we see. I mean, this wasn't the name of our study.
What would change if you went to semiconductors or conductors?
So we also, it's a good question. So we also started to study plasmonic systems, gold nanoparticles, for instance. And in fact, the acceleration goes up to something like 100 UP. It's much, much higher. Mm-hmm. And how you can imagine the difference is that basically in silica, it's an off-resonant driving of the electrons. While in gold, we can excite it at the plasmon frequency. Or, even more interesting, we can drive the system into a state where it gets into resonance as we do the experiment. We did some first experiments using pulses to expand a cluster and then hit it at the right time when it's in the plasmon frequency, when it's resonant, and you see that effect in the emission of high energy electrons, but also in the phase shift between these two events. So the classical phase shift that you know from driven harmonic oscillators applies here. I mean, not one to one, but you can see these phase shifts as well. Yeah.
Where is the next speaker?
He's here.
Oh, there, up here. So, how long have we got?
I missed somehow. Where was now exactly the non-Oppenheimer dynamics?
Yeah. Well, the nuclear and electronic motion in the H2+ is coupled. So as you oscillate the electron, the nuclei move apart. And
is it really in the sense of saying, okay, laser coupled?
Yes.
Okay. Right. But it's not the non-Oppenheimer.
No, the laser induces that coupling. That's right. Yeah.
Okay. We probably should get set up. While he's setting up, can you take one or two questions?
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
When you say feedback, it's not real time feedback. You're talking about adaptive.
Yeah, I mean, doing a measurement, learning how well it fits the desired result, and then feeding it back, changing the parameters of the laser, and trying to optimize it. Yeah.
Quick question.
So, in the first experiment, what's the initial state of the HD?
Of the HD? Is that what you said? Well, you start from the ground state, okay, from the neutral molecule. We have actually done an experiment on HD. It's not on the slides, but then we ionize it, form HD+ in the ground state, predominantly in the ground state. And then what brings it up to the excited state, there can be two things. One is, first, this HD+ expands because of the Franck-Condon region you excited to. It's expanding, and then as it reaches longer distances, a very weak field can excite it directly with the laser to the excited state surface. Or what we have seen in our experiments is that an electron that you emit upon the first ionization can be driven back by the field because it's a strong field environment, and then collide with the ion and leave its energy there, and leads to excitation to this excited state of the ion, and then it dissociates from there. It can still couple to the ground state, but it's two situations. In one case, you start from the ground state, dissociate, and then couple later to the excited state, or you can bring it up to the excited state right away, dissociate, and then couple to the ground state as it undergoes the dissociation. As long as you have the coupling, you will always be able, in principle, to observe the asymmetry.
Okay, thank you.